Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff, president of Euro Pacific Capital and author of the book Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. And I am broadcasting tonight from Boca Raton, Florida. Tomorrow we have our seminar at the Marriott Hotel here. If you're down in the Boca area and you haven't signed up, call the office. The seminar is tomorrow at 5:30. We've already got about 140 people signed up. You know, it's more than I had anticipated. We initially had a room for about 60 or 70 people, and we had to switch rooms. So if you are listening to the show and you're attending tomorrow, make sure to realize that the original room that we had is not where we're meeting. We're going to be meeting at a larger room in the same hotel, so be on the lookout for that. Apparently this is successful down here, and so we might have some more of these type of events in other locations. Anyway, I do this live show every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific, and on my website, www.europac.net, and also on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. And again, the number to call toll-free with any comments or questions is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. And one quick word about the phone calls. I've received numerous emails from listeners complaining about one particular caller who apparently calls on a regular basis, maybe even every show, and generally calls using assumed names, so never necessarily identifies himself as the same person from the same location. And I generally don't want people to call unless they're going to give me, you know, be truthful about, you know, their name and where they're calling from. But apparently this caller has been disruptive, and a lot of people don't appreciate it. And so I would ask this particular caller, whoever you may be, to not call. I mean, maybe call every few months using your correct name and location. But we need to give other people the chance to call in. And apparently the conversations we have sometimes end up being quite lengthy, and it, more people than not are telling me it diminishes from the quality of the show. So I would ask that caller. And I don't even know. I mean, I can't, you know, I don't understand why it's not obvious to me who this caller is. But apparently it's obvious to a number of the listeners. So just want to bring that out there, and we'll try to screen the guy out if we can. You know, of course, you know, there are no real screeners in the show, which is one of the, you know, the interesting aspects of the show, that I am a broker. I've got thousands and thousands of clients, many of whom have been with me for many, many years. The fact that I can even have a call-in show should amaze most brokers. I mean, most brokers on Wall Street, if they had a show like this, they couldn't even proceed. All they would get was calls from people complaining about how much money they lost. So it's interesting that I can even do a show like this, but I want to give callers a chance to get through, and I also want to make sure that the listeners can hear what I've got to say, which is why most people are tuning in. Anyway, a number of things that are going on in the markets. I mainly want to talk on this show again about inflation and how the media and Wall Street constantly confuse the public with respect to inflation, its true causes, and try to minimize it. But looking at what's happened this week with various prices, if you look at the price of gold, new all-time highs now for gold. Gold is above $930 an ounce in the spot market. You know, we first started doing this radio show, gold was around $400. Silver now is almost at $18 an ounce. Platinum, of course, is over $2,000. It's almost $2,200 an ounce. Oil today and yesterday, for the first time ever, traded above $100 a barrel. I do believe that oil prices will ultimately move a lot higher. than 100. I think we can go as high as 150 potentially this year. But, you know, if we don't get to 150 this year, we'll get there next year. You know, but it's not just, you know, oil prices and precious metal prices that are rising as a result of inflation. Look at soybeans. They're now at over $14 a bushel. A couple of years ago, you know, you could have bought soybeans for $5, $6 a bushel. You know, people are focusing now a little bit on inflation. You know, the CPI came out today a little bit higher, like one-tenth higher than what people thought. But again, these numbers are still insignificant. Even though they reveal an annualized inflation rate in excess of 4%, which is still very high inflation. Remember, it was a 4% inflation in the 1970s, the early 70s, that caused Richard Nixon to impose wage and price controls. So that was enough to call for wage and price controls, whereas now we're reporting a 4-plus percent inflation, and the Fed minutes and the Fed governors are telling us that inflation expectations are well contained. So obviously they've dramatically lowered the bar here on what's considered acceptable. You know, back in the 1970s, 4% inflation was, oh my God, we need wage and price controls. And now it means, well, 4% means there's no inflation at all. But of course, the inflation numbers that we report today are completely bogus. I mean, the CPI is absolutely meaningless. It doesn't capture any of the price increases. I'm sure that the true rate of inflation is more than twice the 4% the government admits. I mean, maybe it's even triple what the government admits. And also, again, you know, people are worrying, are these rising oil prices going to lead to inflation down the line? That misses the entire point. These rising oil prices are not going to lead to inflation. Higher oil prices will not cause inflation. Higher oil prices were caused by inflation. They are the result of inflation. And so they're missing the whole point. You know, years ago, I think I wrote a commentary called, you know, Gold or the Government, Which Do You Believe? And basically the commentary was based on the fact that the government was saying there was no inflation, but gold prices were moving up. And I said, well, gold is saying there is inflation. And, you know, gold doesn't lie. Government figures do. Of course, that was years ago. And the people who believed the government bought bonds and bought tips, and they've been killed. The people who trusted gold and bought it instead have had a hedge against inflation, as have people who have bought other commodities, who have invested outside the United States, just as I suggested. You know, along those lines, I want to, you know, mention, you know, it's often very frustrating for me personally. You know, I've been going on television for years now. I've been writing commentaries for longer than that. I have been accurately predicting the economy and the stock market for years. And anybody who's been listening to the show, anybody who's been a client of mine, can certainly attest to the accuracy of my forecasts. And, you know, the legitimacy of my beliefs and my, you know, commitment to what I'm doing, my high regard for my clients and for, you know, their accounts and for the returns that I help them achieve. You know, I spend more and more time over the years convincing clients not to do things, you know, than doing things, you know. You know, back in the 1990s, in the late 1990s, I spent a lot of time convincing people not to buy tech stocks and not to buy internet stocks. I mean, that was almost my entire day was, you know, convincing people not to buy into those, into that mania. And then convincing people not to buy into the Wall Street propaganda and keeping people, you know, in these accounts. You know, we've had many, many pullbacks over the last 8 years in our foreign stocks and in commodities and in precious metals. And, you know, there's been a lot of hand-holding on my part during those 8 years. A lot of times clients have been nervous, and they've called up, and they wanted to change course. They wanted to sell. You know, and despite the fact that we make money on commissions here at Euro Pacific Capital, you know, I have always encouraged people not to sell and not to overtrade. And in the long run, you know, this has certainly worked to their advantage. Whether it's been to my advantage or not, it remains to be seen. Certainly, I would have earned more commissions had we done more trading. But, of course, my clients have done very well, and so as a result, I have, you know, earned their confidence, earned more of their money, and we have certainly benefited from tremendous referrals from satisfied clients. So it's hard to say. But the reason I bring this up is I had a reporter that came in and interviewed me for Forbes magazine, and I was, you know, very excited that they wanted to profile me and do an article about me. And I spent a lot of time with this reporter. And, you know, the reporter, you know, basically went over you know, everything I've said, I went over my entire career with him in the late 1990s and what I was writing and saying to people about the dot-com bubble and how I began to move people out of the dollar, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s and how I became increasingly bearish. And I went over all my accurate calls on the dollar, commodities, oil, gold, you know, foreign stocks. I went over our whole strategy and the returns that clients have made. I showed him a lot of emails that I had received over the years from clients and just fans of mine who weren't even clients but who had followed my advice, you know, through other brokerage firms. You know, I showed him a lot of my video seminars, things from the Money Show, and you know, a lot of the things that I had said about the housing bubble, you know, years ago, and you know, showed him a lot of the videos of me on Fox and on Bloomberg, and a lot of the things that I had said that had come true, and you know, I mean, he really learned a lot about me. He asked for the names of several clients of mine to talk to, and he didn't really talk to the people, but he talked to one of the three. But of course, she said very good things about me, about how well she had done, and how, you know, how my advice has been accurate. Anyway, so, you know, he spent a lot of time with me, and we talked about a lot of things. None of these things really made it into the article. The article just came out, and it's basically a hit piece on me. The article basically tries to discredit me. It tries to paint me as a charlatan, as a huckster, as a promoter, that I, you know, it doesn't give me credit at all for having accurately forecast anything, despite the fact that he knows how accurate my forecasts are. In fact, when I showed him some information, and he spoke to the sponsor of the Western Regional Mortgage Bankers Association, which is a function I spoke at twice in 2004, 5 and 2006, basically forecasting all the problems. I was in a debate with industry heads from mortgage brokers, from realtors, and I pretty much laid out the entire problem in subprime in exactly the way it was going to unfold. And, of course, you know, doesn't even mention any of that stuff. It doesn't mention any of the conversation with my client, doesn't talk about how well my clients have done. Instead, he tries to paint me, again, as a promoter who's getting rich by basically having a spiel. And, of course, you know, I mean, I know I make some money doing what I'm doing. There's no question about it. But, you know, compared to what, you know, most executives make on Wall Street, compared to what people make at Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers, I mean, I'm nobody. I'm a piker. I'm chump change compared to what these guys make. But the real story would have been Wall Street makes a fortune giving their clients lousy investment advice. I mean, think of all the people that bought dot-coms and bought subprime mortgages from these big firms. These guys are making billions, you know, or tens or hundreds of millions giving out lousy investment advice, defrauding their customers, defrauding their shareholders. Here I am, a small guy from a small firm who has gotten it right, who has basically gotten everything that the big mainstream Wall Street firms got wrong. I got it right, right? I cared for my clients. I put their interests ahead of mine. That should have been a good story, you know, like a David and Goliath. Here I am, a small guy, you know, I've fought the odds, I've been able to succeed by giving accurate investment advice and by really working to benefit my clients. Instead, it's a complete hit piece for no reason whatsoever. This guy doesn't know me, you know, and he was very nice to me the whole time he spoke to me. Of course, you know, he violated some confidence. He makes it look like, you know, there were the three clients that he was going to interview. I had spoken to these three clients in advance, and they had said that it was okay for me to discuss their accounts with this reporter, and that they were willing to speak to the reporter about their accounts, and they were all perfectly willing to have their names in the story. But of course, what nobody thought would enter into the story was the dollar amount of their investments. And when we found out that he was going to do that, none of them wanted their names in there because they didn't think that was relevant to the story. But he wanted to make it look like, you know, I showed him information that I shouldn't have. Like, I didn't care about my clients, when the reason that he was seeing these accounts with their permission was he wanted proof that we were doing what I claimed I was doing, that I was buying foreign stocks, that people were making money. You know, he wanted to see my own accounts because he didn't believe me. And I tried to say, look, we're obviously making money. Look at my predictions. Look at what I've been saying for the last 7 or 8 years. How can we not be doing well based on what I've been recommending? But, you know, I showed him the information. And then, of course, he ends up putting the dollar values, approximate dollar values of my account in the story, as if that had any relevance whatsoever. The point he was trying to make was that I was making a lot of money, or at least obviously in his position a lot of money, basically by scamming people, by just basically being a broken clock that, you know, I've been saying the same thing for 10 years, and now all of a sudden I'm right. Well, first of all, I'm not just all of a sudden right. I've been saying the same thing for 10 years, and I've been right for 10 years. It's not like my clients are making money now in 2008. They made money in 2000, in 2001, in 2002, in 2003, every year up until now. In fact, this is one of the years that they're probably one of the years that's not nearly as good as prior years. I mean, the people, the gold investments and oil investments are, but in general, you know, we had much, much stronger years in 2002 and 2003 and 2004. You know, this year has been a little rough. But the article tries to make it out like, you know, here I am finally, because the dollar is finally down and there's some bad news on the economy, that I'm out there, you know, playing off of this and finally getting rich. Basically, in fact, the title of the story is basically, you know, how to get rich. You know, it's like the focus is that I'm making money, not that my clients are making money or that I'm even doing a good job for my clients, just that I'm making money for myself. And the way to make money for yourself is just to come up with a spiel and say it loud enough and then wait for the market to go your way and pounce on it. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible story. But what it really shows you is the incredible bias in the media. I mean, here's this Forbes reporter. You know, this should have been a good story. As I said, it should have been a David and Goliath-type story of a small, you know, one-man shop firm that's growing, you know, that is outside the mainstream, that's been saying black while everybody else has been saying right. And you know what? The guy's been right, and his clients have benefited from it. That should have been the story, not the hit piece, not the smear piece. I mean, the people who should be smeared are the executives at all these big firms that cram these dot-coms down the throats of their clients, that cram these subprime mortgages, that kept people in the U.S. dollar, in U.S. stocks. Well, I was doing the opposite, and I was swimming upstream. It's much easier to give your clients what they want. It's much more difficult to explain to your clients what they need and to go against the crowd. But, of course, he didn't give me any credit for that at all. But anyway, what I'm hoping to do, I want to try to launch a boycott of Forbes. So if anybody who is listening to this radio show, if you happen to be a subscriber to Forbes, and I used to like the magazine, and it's a shame because I'm not going to read it anymore, but if you have a subscription, I would advise you to cancel it. I'd advise you to send a letter to Forbes explaining why you're canceling it. You also might want to send an email or letter to the reporter. The guy's name is Michael Maio, and just let him know, you know, what you think of his article. And, you know, certainly if you're a happy Euro-Pacific Capital client, you might let him know that you've had a very good experience and you really appreciate Peter Schiff, and it's unfortunate that he decided to do a personal vendetta and hit job against me for no reason at all. And potentially that you will no longer subscribe to Forbes magazine or buy it off the newsstands. Also, potentially, maybe we can organize a boycott for advertisers, people who advertise their products in Forbes. But my guess is maybe it's a hit job on me, because there's probably a lot of advertisers in Forbes from the mainstream media, from the mainstream brokerage firms, who have done such a lousy job over the years, who have given such terrible investment advice to their clients. And so rather than writing a positive piece about a small firm that has given good advice, they need to attack that small firm for the benefit of the rest of their advertisers. Anyway, I know I've been ranting a little bit. This article just came out today. And as I said, it's very, you know, very disturbing that this is the take that this reporter decided to have on something that I'm very proud of. I'm very proud of the work that I've done and of the tremendous success I've had for my clients. Certainly, I've made some money myself, but if you compare what I've made relative to the returns my clients have achieved, I'm the best value out there. As I said, these guys on Wall Street are making a fortune, and all their clients and all their shareholders are getting killed, absolutely killed. Anyway, let me grab one call, and then we'll take a commercial. I know we have a few calls lining up. Let me take Greg from California. Go ahead, Greg.
Hi, Peter.
Hey.
About your 150 oil call, possibly for this year, how do you see that playing out? Do you think that if the Fed keeps cutting the rate down to zero, that's just going to happen eventually? Or,
well, I don't think they're going to cut the rate to zero this year. But, you know, oil prices have been rising consistently for 8 years. I mean, a 50% appreciation from here would certainly be pretty substantial. But I think oil prices have appreciated by 50% at least six times over the last 8 years. So And could it happen in 1 year? Certainly. So I think that we could get as high as 150. I don't necessarily know that we're going to hit 150 this year. I think that we will probably certainly hit 150 by next year, sometime next year, if we don't hit it this year. But I think we're going higher. I think the chart is extremely bullish on oil. I think $100 could be the new floor for oil prices. And, you know, we can certainly move up to 115, 120 in the short run before the next pullback. It's not just oil. Look at commodities across the board. I mean, look at platinum prices at, $2,100, $2,200 an ounce. You know, gold is $930, $940. Silver is almost $18. Look at corn. Look at wheat. Look at soybeans. I mean, these commodities are going through the roof. The whole CRB index is at an all-time record high. And, inflation is a problem all over the world. Look what's going on in China. Look at they're trying to impose wage and price controls in China. Their official CPI is now running at better than 7% a year. I mean, this is an economy with tremendous economic growth. Prices should be falling in China. Think of all the increased productivity. Think about all the new production coming out of Chinese farms. Food prices should be falling. But the Chinese government is printing so much money to try to preserve their peg to the dollar, to try to prop up our currency. You know, America is exporting inflation all over the world because all throughout Asia and all throughout the Middle East, these countries have adopted our monetary policy. They've got peg currencies. We are basically forcing our irresponsibility and cramming our inflation down the throats of the rest of the world. So it's global inflation. So it's not just the weak dollar that's causing oil prices to rise. It's the weak renminbi. It's the weak real. It's the weak yen. It's all these currencies that are weak simultaneously. Everybody is debasing their currency, and prices are just going to keep rising until it stops. And I do think eventually the rest of the world will stop. They will finally pull the plug on these currency pegs, let their own currencies go up, and then finally we'll start to see prices falling in China, but then they're going to go through the roof in America. Because then, when the dollar is allowed to really sink without the support of everybody else, then the dollar is just going to fall through the floor. And then you're really going to see oil prices go up. I mean, they can go to $200 a barrel or $300 a barrel. But those prices could actually represent significant reductions for people who are paying with other currencies.
Very interesting. My other question is about real estate prices. Do you think it's possible that inflation will get so bad and the dollar will go down so much that real estate prices won't necessarily move as far as nominal terms?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the goals of the government is to create enough inflation that they can, they can keep real estate prices, nominal real estate prices, from falling. What they have to do is create enough inflation so that people's incomes rise. Well, one of the problems is, people's income is not rising. Certainly the cost of living is going up, but incomes are not rising. But I think in real terms, which is the only thing that counts. I mean, nominal terms don't matter, right? If they destroy the currency, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you live in a $1 million condo if there's $10,000 worth of food in your refrigerator, right? It doesn't really mean anything. But I do believe that in real terms, I think real estate prices in the United States, in real terms, meaning if you price a house in an ounce of gold, I think you're going to see average home prices at the lowest levels in U.S. history, probably including the Great Depression. And that's because we had such an unprecedented real estate bubble. We had so much excess in the real estate market. We overbuilt the market so much. We had so much speculation that it's going to be a huge collapse. Now, it doesn't mean real estate prices are going to stay at those levels. But, it's like a pendulum. You swing way out in one direction, and then you swing way out in the other direction. Eventually, real estate prices will rise back up to a normal price. Let's say real estate is 30% overvalued nationwide. It's probably going to have to go way undervalued before it can come back to where it really will be. But, in the short run, there's a lot of downside in real estate. It still doesn't make sense to try to buy. I still think renting is a better deal. And continuing to put money aside, get it out of the dollar, get it into foreign currencies, foreign assets, precious metals, and wait. Because I think if you do that, there's a good chance you'll be able to buy a house without a mortgage, own it free and clear. And it won't matter that mortgage rates are 20%. I hear a lot of people telling me, look, I want to buy a house now because, I can get a cheap mortgage. No, I'd rather buy the house cheap. And even if you need a mortgage, so let's say you buy a $400,000 house with a 6% mortgage. Well, maybe it's better to buy a $150,000 house with a 12% mortgage. Maybe your payments will be lower. you know, because your principal is less. And, of course, you can always refinance when interest rates eventually fall at some point in the future. But maybe if you could do it right, you won't need a mortgage at all. You can buy the house for all cash. And if you got gold bullion to pay, or euros or Australian dollars or New Zealand dollars or some other currency, houses are going to get a lot cheaper for you.
Makes sense. Thanks.
All right, thanks for the call. Let me take a quick commercial, and we will be right back for more calls.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we are back. And again, the number to call toll-free is 888-678-9597. 888-678-9597. And I will go back to the phones. Gary is calling from North Dakota. Go ahead, Gary.
Thank you for taking my call. I had listened to a recent conversation that you participated in, which a couple of your comments I found to be somewhat, I didn't understand what you were, I was wondering if you could clarify. In that conversation, you had said that you noted that the interest rate on the 10-year treasuries has gone up significantly just here in the last few days. And you said that now if this trend continues, and we in interest rates go significantly higher, that this could have a deleterious effect on the stock market. Now, here's why I'm confused. I had always felt that or been told that when bonds are selling off, I mean treasuries are selling off, which causes the rates to go higher, that that would be bullish for equities because that investment money is transferring out of the bond market and into the stock market. But yet you were seeing interest rates going higher, meaning bonds are selling off, and that...
Well, first of all, potentially, if you're saying that a lot of money was leaving stocks, was leaving bonds for stocks, and that meant that interest rates were backing up for that reason, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about rising interest rates as a cost of borrowed money. You know, corporations have to borrow a lot of money, and as interest rates go up, it costs corporations more to borrow. Also, as interest rates rise, it diminishes the value of stocks on a formula, because when you have a stock, the value of that is the present value of its future earnings, and it's discounted by an interest rate, and the higher the interest rate is, the less those future earnings are worth today. So higher interest rates directly diminishes a stock's value, and it diminishes corporate earnings. But the broader picture here is that everybody is counting on low interest rates to save homeowners. That's the whole idea. These rate cuts, the Fed is cutting rates. It's supposed to help people refinance their mortgages. This is supposed to be salvation. But if interest rates rise instead, because the Fed controls short-term interest rates, not long-term interest rates, and if the Fed rate cuts are producing rising long-term interest rates, then that's going to make mortgages more expensive, not less expensive. And nobody is expecting that, and that is what will knock the legs out from under the stock market, the housing market, and the economy.
So in other words, you're envisioning the bonds going lower and stocks going lower simultaneously, isn't...
Yes, and in fact, that's what's happened. If you actually look at what's happened over the last few months, both stock prices and bond prices are now down. You know, because like I said, you know, we've had a very big backup. The 10-year yield got down to below 3.3% 4 weeks ago, and today it closed at 3.92%. That's a significant rate of increase. And, you know, if we continue to increase at this pace, 2 months from now, the yield on the 10-year will be over 5%. And, you know, I mean, and that's still not an expensive yield historically, but that's probably enough to bring mortgage rates, fixed-rate mortgages, back up to 7.5%, 8%. And, you know, I mean, right now they're, you know, they're under 6%. So, I mean, these are those. That's a, that would be a very significant move were that to happen. Now, I mean, the bond market is one thing that's confounded me. I mean, I've made a number of predictions over the years, and they pretty much all have come true, with the exception of the bond market. I have long believed that we would see a substantial increase in long-term interest rates as a result of all the inflation that the Fed is creating, as a result of the weakness in the dollar, yet that has not come to pass. Interest rates are much lower today than they were, let's say, 5 years ago, and they shouldn't be. They should be higher. But again, I think this is a bubble, and eventually the bond market's going to collapse. You know, it wasn't too long ago that people thought lending money to subprime borrowers who couldn't pay you back was a great idea. And these bonds were valued at par a year ago, and now, you know, a lot of them are worth nothing. So, you know, people can have one concept of what a bond is worth one day and a completely different concept the very next. And right now people think that buying 30-year Treasury bonds yielding 4.6% is a good idea. You know, we might wake up tomorrow and they think that that's a lousy idea, in which case the price will collapse.
The part that I find counterintuitive is where you're saying the bond market and stock market would collapse simultaneously, where the conventional thinking has always been that if bonds are selling off, then that money's going to go into the...
Yeah, it's not. It's going to be an exodus of U.S. dollar assets in general, and it'll be a flight from dollars and from dollar-denominated assets to gold, to other commodities, to foreign assets. You know, that's where the money is going to flow. And, you know, we've had that. You know, you go back in the 1970s, right? We had a huge bear market in bonds. I mean, bonds collapsed during the 1970s. People lost more money in bonds during the 1970s than they lost in stocks. But we had a bear market in both. The Dow Jones lost a lot of value during the 70s, and the bond market lost a lot of value. And so, you know, that's kind of normal. You know, have to have a bear market in both. You know, we had a bull market in both. You know, for the 1980s and 1990s, there was a bull market in bonds and a bull market in stocks. Anyway, well, thank you very much for the call. I've got other people on hold. Let me take a call from Marty in Maryland.
Hi, Peter. Great show.
Marty.
Peter, I was often think about Don Cox. He used to do a radio internet piece. He said, you know, the first jobs that ever should have been outsourced to China were the energy analyst on Wall Street.
Yeah, well, they certainly missed the mark. Most of them have, anyway, over the years.
Well, on to my main point. Peter, I've been fortunate. I've been in the resource sector for 8 years, thanks to Poplava, Jim Sinclair, David Morgan, and now you. But anyway, a good portion of my portfolio is in the junior exploration, gold and silver, and uranium stocks. And as you know, they've really taken a hit here the last year and a half and really haven't done anything. I do hold some of the majors, and that's kind of helped, but... what's your perspective on the junior producers and explorers that just have done nothing the last year?
I think there's some great value there. I mean, I've been buying more of those names myself. And, you know, I think the fact that these names have done so poorly, I really, to me, shows how, you know, how there's not that much speculation, how many people really are doubting this move. You know, the mainstream media still makes fun of people who are buying gold and buying gold stocks. And so I don't think there's been a lot of speculation. I think companies have had a hard time attracting money, attracting financing, these small companies. And also, you know, I've written quite often and spoke about it over the years that gold stocks and mining companies have been one of the ironic victims of inflation, because inflation has been so rampant and so pervasive that the cost of mining and the cost of exploration have gone up so much, much more rapidly than the price of gold and silver. Yep. And so even though prices have moved up, these companies have not made money or attracted capital. Now, I think that is changing. I think if you look at what's happening now with the trajectory in both gold and silver and platinum and other metals, I think that's going to change. I think you're going to see the major companies are going to start to show some better earnings, some earnings surprises. I think you're going to see more attention paid to the majors, to the Newmonts and the Barricks, you know, by Wall Street. And as, you know, more capital is going into these stocks, you know, it's going to, you know, cause a lot of these juniors to finally start to move. I mean, there's going to be more acquisitions, larger companies are going to be buying some of these smaller companies for their pipelines, for their resource and exploration potential. There's going to be more capital seeking out the industry. More money is going to go there. So if you really want to speculate and you want to buy some stocks and go up 10 or 100 fold, I mean, that's where you're going to find them. Some of these junior stocks, I think, are going to be huge winners for people. And I think people who have sold them in the last year, who have just lost their patience, it's unfortunate. But, that's how bull markets are. They want to take as few people along for the ride as possible. There are a lot of people that maybe were in the market that didn't really have the conviction or the true understanding as to what was going on. And so a lot of those players or a lot of speculators might have been shaken out of the market. But I think the people who understand and who invest, or with a long-term horizon, I think there's going to be huge rewards in these stocks, particularly at the end of the move. I think probably in the last 1 or 2 years of this bull move in precious metals, which I think ultimately will end in a mania at some point. I mean, we're nowhere near there yet, but I'm sure at the end, that's when these stocks are going to have their most spectacular moves up.
How about uranium, Peter? Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, uranium did great. I mean, and people made a lot of money in uranium already. I think about a year ago or so, I think uranium kind of became mainstream when, Cramer on CNBC was touting uranium stocks. A lot of big money was made in uranium a few years before Cramer ever heard of the stuff. So I think it got a little bit too many speculators came in to the uranium story. But ultimately, I'm still very bullish long term on uranium, and I still think that there's more money to be made in the sector. But right now, I think that I'd still be concentrating on the precious metals. So I think there's going to be some explosive moves there.
Can you foresee? I mean, right now, it looks like the spot market on uranium is around 75. Do you see this pretty close to being the bottom?
I don't know. I mean, I think uranium prices ultimately are going to go much higher.
I do too.
But because the real dynamics for the industry, if you understand them, really argue for substantially higher uranium prices.
Sure. And Cameco, who knows where they're at? Because that mine flooded, and it may never be restored.
Yeah. Anyway, well, thanks for the call, Marty.
Okay.
And let me grab Bob calling from New York. Go ahead, Bob.
Hey, Peter. We missed you at the Money Show in Orlando.
But I am here in Boca Raton, though, so I'm not too far from Orlando, so some people will get to see me tomorrow at my seminar here in Boca. But I will be at the Money Show in Las Vegas. I did sign up for that one.
I want to tell you about my confrontation with Battipaglia and Steve Forbes. Battipaglia had the gall to get up and claim that last year at the Orlando Money Show, he warned everybody how bad things would be. He got up and he completely lied about how he had been a bear. Here's a man who's on videotape debating you in the Bull and Bears.
And that one, I just put up on the website, the only one that I had, which was the most recent Bull and Bear debate. But in prior Bull and Bear debates, many of the things that I said, that have happened, I mean, Battipaglia was attacking me. But, I don't want to be too hard on Battipaglia because at least he's turned around. At least he's one of the better guys on television now. He's one of the few guys that seems to understand there's a problem now. Maybe I had some small part in that.
Yeah, what I objected
to. He didn't want to credit me for it, but,
What I objected to was his lying. Mm-hmm. That he had been a bear last year. So I walked over to him as he got off the platform, and I said, you're a little bit too heavy to be Peter Schiff, but obviously you became Peter Schiff. Because all of a sudden you claim to be a bear, when in fact you were not a bear last year, you were a bull last year. And he got very angry and stormed off. He didn't even respond. And then after Steve Forbes got up and gave one of his typical, rah, 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 everything is wonderful speech, I walked over to him and I said, unlike most of the people in this audience, I actually have a memory. And I can tell you that you spoke at the Washington, D.C. Money Show, and you stated that you guarantee that within 6 months, oil will be $35 a barrel. So he says, I guess I got that wrong. I said, as a matter of fact, there's nothing that you've gotten right. And he looked at me as if, how dare a plebeian like me speak to a patrician like him in that manner? So he stormed off. These people are absolute liars. I wouldn't mind if
Steve Forbes is one of his big things has always been oil's going to collapse, oil's going to collapse, oil's going to collapse, because he doesn't understand inflation. He pretends that he does, and he says a lot of the right things about it. But now it doesn't surprise me that Forbes is doing this hit piece on me, because they're so, I mean, they're so rah-rah the United States, and it's unfortunate, you know, that the biggest, you know, promoters of patriotism, of phony patriotism, are coming from the right wing. People who are supposedly conservative, who are free market capitalists, are the ones that are so championing this country. And it's so unfortunate, because we're about to collapse, and they are handing, number one, this election to the Democrats on a silver platter. Obama is going to win in the biggest landslide in election history. And I don't know if these Republican ideals, you know, they completely vilified or, you know, it marginalized Ron Paul, who's the only person in the Republican Party who actually talks about Republican principles of limited government and freedom and the
old saying.
And then, you know, and they want to vilify me in the same way. Anybody who dares to point out that there's actually something wrong with our economy, that there's a problem, has got to be vilified. They've got to be labeled a kook, just somebody who's who's just a charlatan, a huckster, somebody with a gimmick and a shtick, you know. I mean, this is the attitude that Forbes has, and it's the attitude of a lot of people in the media, and it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that they've done this, because it's, you know, I think it's going to do a lot of harm to this country.
I was in your New York City office. I met your brother today.
Oh, great.
And I met one of your new brokers. I brought a guy who used to play for the New York Yankees to open up an account, and he met with one of your new brokers, a very sharp kid named David Whitehouse, who lived in China at one time and speaks Chinese. And also James Phipps was at the meeting. So you got some pretty sharp guys over there.
Yeah, he's fluent in Chinese as well, James. But yeah, and you know, part of the whole problem with the story, you know, the Forbes story, they took a photograph of me in my New York office. They were supposed to talk right about the fact that I was expanding, that, you know, most of Wall Street is contracting. Most of Wall Street is laying people off. Here I am hiring people. I'm getting all these new clients. I need new brokers. You know, when everybody else is shrinking, I'm growing, because while they've been losing money for their clients, I've been making money for mine. You would think that would be a good story. But no, the truth wasn't a good story. They thought it was a better story to try to vilify me and make me out like I was some kind of a kook, a promoter, shyster, you know.
I can guarantee
money off of a scam.
That writer, I can guarantee you, was assigned to do that hit piece. He didn't do that of his own volition. He was directed to do it.
I have no idea why he did it. I mean, some people are just jerks, you know. I don't know. I mean, some people just have their own agendas. So I have no idea if he was told to do it or if he did it on his own accord. But, you know, it's just so typical of what's out there, you know, and the lack of credibility and respect that is given to me, by most of the mainstream. Now, there's a few. I mean, there are some reporters that I've talked to who have, you know, who have acknowledged the fact that, hey, I've been right, and I've, you know, and the things that I've been saying have been right. And, you know, I do get on, you know, I'm not like I'm not on television. I mean, I get on television so that they don't keep me off. But most of the people don't, you know, I mean, if I was working at Merrill Lynch or, you know, Morgan Stanley and had gotten half the things right that I got right, I mean, they, you know, I'd be all over the place.
Exactly. Well, you've been very lucky, because most people who take a principled position, as you do, have a lot of trouble making money. So the fact that you've been able to make a few dollars at the same time as you're standing up for truth puts you in a very unique position.
This reporter was so upset that I was making some money. Look at all the adjectives that he chose to throw into the sentences, the way he described me. I mean, he went out of his way to make me sound like, you know, like a bad person, or like just like a, you know, I mean, even though I'm the complete opposite of that.
But Stan O'Neill from Merrill Lynch is a genius.
Oh, you know, that's my part of my point.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for the call.
All right, bye.
Bye, Bob. Okay, I got Gavin on the line from California. Go ahead, Gavin.
How you doing, Peter? Really nice to talk with you. I want to thank you for all your support and patriotism in supporting the Ron Paul campaign. And second, I'd like to ask you just very particularly about how can you expect the housing prices to continue to fall while at the same time predicting that gold will rise, since the housing price index has had a fixed relationship to gold historically?
Well, because we've had a bubble. I mean, we haven't had, historically, we haven't had housing bubbles. And so when people try to look at the past to try to predict the future from housing prices, it doesn't really work because the past doesn't include the bubble that we've just had. So prices are going to have to fall substantially in real estate from here based on what's happened. I mean, based on the overbuilding, based on the glut of unsold homes. I mean, it's just, you know, based on all the vacancies. I mean, the number of homes that are empty. It, you know, based on all the people who own homes that are going to be walking away from their mortgages, that are just going to, you know, I mean, you remember, people have borrowed so much money against their homes. Many people have refinanced. You know, there's articles about people who have refinanced four, five, six times over the last 10 or 15 years. People have taken away hundreds of thousands of dollars. The best thing that they can do is hand the keys to the bank. So you're going to have so many foreclosures and so many homes on the market and so few people who are qualified or able to buy them and so few people willing to lend them the money to do it. Remember, people can only borrow a house if they can borrow money, right? I mean, it's not an all-cash market yet. So you have to get a mortgage. Well, the problem is somebody has to be willing to lend you the money. And the people with the savings are in China. They're in Saudi Arabia and Japan and Europe. Why would they want to loan an American money at 6 or 7% so we can buy a house over a 30-year mortgage? There's no way they're going to do it. So interest rates are going to go up dramatically, and that means housing prices have to fall. In that respect, they're like bonds. If mortgage rates go up to 12 or 15%, what's going to have to happen to housing prices, which can only be financed based on borrowed money? You know, just like people were able to afford to pay a lot of money for homes when they can get interest-only teaser rates, the minute they have to pay high interest rates, they can only pay a little bit of money for a house. And that's what the house is worth. It doesn't matter what it costs to build. All that matters is what is somebody willing and able to pay for it when it gets sold. And so houses can sell for a fraction of the cost to build them. The cost is meaningless when it comes to the value of the house.
Right. And in the second portion of that question, that I was wondering about is one of the portions of the stimulus package and one of the parts of it is that part of the inflationary tool of the government that they're using now is this conforming loan up to $740,000 in more expensive markets or around 5%. You don't think that will change? That will be enough to change the equation in any significant way?
No, I mean, obviously by allowing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to buy more expensive mortgages for a year or two, that will help to, reduce the rapid rate at which real estate prices fall, because it will enable some people to refinance a mortgage to something affordable that they couldn't have refinanced before, because there was no private sector demand for the mortgage, but the government was willing to buy it up, or a government-sponsored entity. So it will diminish to some extent of foreclosures. It will allow houses to sell for prices that are higher than they otherwise would have sold for. But ultimately, it's not going to change anything. Housing prices are still going to go down, even if they go down somewhat more slowly. And ultimately, what ends up happening is bad mortgages end up being transferred from the private sector to the public sector, meaning they're ultimately, when these mortgages go bad, it is that much more inflationary, as now it's a government problem, not just a problem for the individual lender.
Okay, and then my final question, this is a very quick question, it has to do with equities. And, the question that I'm trying to figure out in doing more investment with Euro Pacific Capital, I'm currently a client and doing very well there, but one thing I was wondering about was, since so many large cap companies are multinationals in the first place, can you please explain the difference or the advantages of purchasing stocks in dollars that derive the majority of their revenues from overseas versus buying directly on the foreign exchange in foreign denominated.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if you're going to buy U.S. stocks at all, the ones to buy are the ones that are natural resource oriented or the ones that are multinational and derive a significant percentage of their earnings from outside the United States. If you're going to buy U.S. stocks, those are the ones to buy. The reason is that I prefer to invest outside the United States is I would rather buy companies that get all their earnings from outside the United States than just 40 or 50 or 60% of their earnings. Plus, I find that we can buy companies on foreign markets for lower PEs than what we're going to pay for stocks in the U.S. So we're getting more stock for our money, or more importantly, more dividend for our money, because the dividend yields that we can get outside the United States are much higher than the yields that we can get inside the United States. And since that's the real reason for buying stocks, is to enjoy dividend income, it makes much more sense to invest abroad. And there's a whole other, a lot of other problems. I'm afraid of U.S. corporate income tax rates rising. I'm afraid of things like windfall profit taxes. I mean, you don't have governments in other countries. You know, I own Australian oil stocks, for example. I don't hear Australian governments talking about imposing windfall profit taxes on Australian oil companies, yet it happens all the time here in the United States. And so I would be afraid, let's say I was buying U.S. oil companies, and all of a sudden, you know, the Democrats are, you know, and they want to vilify the oil companies, and they slap these huge taxes and diminish the value of U.S. oil companies. So I'd rather take my chances abroad right now because I don't think you have that kind of rhetoric in other countries. But anyway, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
I've got two more calls. Let me take Mary calling from California.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, Mary. How are you?
Pretty good. I was wondering what you think of the term auction facility. Is it like a secret type of bailout? And how far do you think it'll go? Last I read, it was around $50 billion.
Are you talking about the auctions that are being done by the Fed as far as, you know, where they're accepting, you know, mortgage-backed securities secretly as collateral for loans? Yeah, I mean, look, this is, again, this is another way of the government to introduce more inflation into the system to try to take on, you know, to try to bring these assets, these questionable securities, to the Fed in exchange for freshly created money. This is why, you know, the price of gold is rising. This is why the price of oil is rising, because the government is monetizing this problem. The government is allowing lenders to move these assets, you know, not off their books, but pledge them as collateral for loans, even though the real value of these securities is highly questionable. But, you know, this should not be being done. But, again, our politicians and our central bankers, their job, in their opinion, is simply to keep the wolves at bay as long as possible. They don't care how much worse they make the problem. They couldn't care less about the long-term future of this economy or anybody who lives here. All they care about is their own political careers, their own reelection. How can we stay in office? How can we pretend that everything is okay? And so this is what these guys are doing. And you as an investor, as a saver, as an American, need to understand this so you can think for yourself. And so you can at least preserve your own wealth so that you don't go down with this ship like everybody else. So it's unfortunate. And, you know, I would much rather have a different take on things. But unfortunately, I have to call it the way I see it, even if some people in the, you know, in the media don't like it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Let me take, I've got another call from Chad in Minnesota. Go ahead, Chad.
Hi, Peter.
Hey.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Say, wanted to call. I got a big picture question for you. But before I ask you, I just wanted to thank you for all your hard work.
Sure.
So, learned a lot from you over the last couple of years.
Glad I can be of help.
Yeah. I'm just, I think I got this figured out, but I just wanted to run this past you. You know, they keep saying that we've got a service-based economy here in America, and because we're a service-based economy, doesn't that mean the dollars are just flowing between people, you know, between entities here within our borders?
Well, what they're talking about a service economy is that the majority of Americans earn a living in the service sector. You know, we're basically working as lawyers and accountants and stockbrokers like me that we're providing services as opposed to people who work producing goods, right?
Right.
And since we have such a disproportionate number of people in the service sector, they refer to us as a service economy. The problem is it's not viable. If our trade was in balance, then and we still were providing services, then we could be a service economy. But when we have a $60 billion a month trade deficit, it's not a service economy. It's a bubble economy. It's a bubble because we don't have enough people producing things because we don't balance the books. We don't pay for our imports. It's like I've used, you know, an analogy to think about is let's assume that, you know, a group of people were to be stranded on an island, right? And we got to this island and we decided to divvy up the work. What are we going to do? And one person says, I want to be the accountant for the island. And another person says, I want to be a lawyer. Another person wants to be a philosopher, you know, and everybody picks a service sector job, right? Well, meanwhile, everybody dies because there's no food to eat. We all starve. The only way that somebody can be an accountant and somebody can be a lawyer is if somebody else is getting the food or producing the products. You can only have a service sector economy built on the foundation of a manufacturing economy. Somebody's got to make stuff. Now, I suppose if you can provide a service that is so valuable that you can export it, and that maybe other people in other countries that make things want those services so badly that they're willing to send you their products for your services, then okay, maybe you can have a service sector economy, which is something that you have maybe in Switzerland. You have in Switzerland, there are a lot of financial services that the world wants, and so the Swiss earn a lot of money doing things like banking, and then they're able to take those banking earnings and import products they didn't manufacture. But America's service sector economy doesn't do that. We don't export enough services to pay for all the products we import. So we have a phony economy. We have a bubble economy. To try to just say we have a service sector economy and to ignore the $60 billion a month trade deficit is ridiculous and disingenuous, and it's basically it's wrong. And that's why, you know, in my book I talk about America as a bubble economy and why it's going to collapse, because it's not viable. The service sector economy is like an internet stock. You know, what was the internet stocks? You know, they had no earnings. They just had revenues, and some of them didn't even have revenues. They weren't legitimate businesses. Subprime mortgages, right? People thought they were valuable. But how can a loan from somebody who can't pay you back have any value, right? But these are crazy things, crazy concepts that people bought. Well, it's the same thing about an economy that perpetually runs a trade deficit. It's just as nonsense as the dot-coms were or the subprime mortgages, and it will suffer the same fate.
Yep. Yeah, so really, the Feds are actually kind of manipulating the GDP numbers as well, aren't they?
Well,
isn't that why the Federal Reserve keeps printing money to pump up this economy, is because we're really not creating anything of value?
Well, I mean, we're creating some things of value, but unfortunately we're not creating enough things of value to pay for all the goods that we consume. But yeah, the numbers, I mean, over the years, that's what the government has done. That's what politicians have done. To try to create the illusion that the economy is more successful than it is so that they can get the credit for it, as if the government actually were the reason for economic growth, which it's not, it's individuals and freedom. If anything, government detracts from that or builds barriers to growth. But so politicians could claim false credit for economic success, they doctor up the numbers. They change it. They constantly change the way they calculate economic statistics so that the good things look better and the bad things look not as bad. So when it comes to growth, they get higher numbers for growth. When it comes to productivity, they get higher numbers for productivity. But when it comes to inflation, they report lower numbers. When it comes to unemployment, they report lower numbers because they change the methodology for calculating it. Things are counted that weren't counted. Things that aren't counted that used to be counted. It's all a game, but it's all nonsense. It's all politicians telling us things are great as they're getting bad. I mean, that's why if you look at the elections now, right, look at the primaries. The voters are saying that the number one issue is the economy. The economy is the number one issue. Yet according to the government, the economy is fantastic. Inflation is non-existent and unemployment is the lowest ever. I mean, if that's really the case, then the economy should be the furthest thing from the voter's mind. The fact that the economy is such a paramount concern in every voter shows you that the economy is lousy, because people are only voting the economy when the economy is bad. They're not voting the economy when it's good. And again, I've mentioned the reporters and the media in Wall Street, they think it's a disconnect. They think the public doesn't get it, that they don't realize how good it is. The problem is Wall Street doesn't realize how bad it is. They just stare at government numbers. They don't know what their chauffeur pays for gasoline or what their housekeeper is paying for food. They couldn't care less. They look at these government numbers and think everything is great. But the average American who's voting in these primaries, they do their own grocery shopping. They buy their own gas. They know what's going on. They know how tenuous their jobs are if they have one. They know what's happening to the value of their house, and they see what's happening to their mortgages. They realize, I mean, more than ever before, if you look at the statistics, Americans are spending a higher percentage of their income on necessities, which are food, energy, insurance, health care, taxes, you know, than ever before. There's not a lot of money left over for the fun things or for leisure. So the economy is getting worse, even as the politicians are claiming credit for how great things are.
Yep.
Anyway, thanks for your call. I'm running out of time.
Thank you.
I got less than a minute. Well, anyway, thanks, everybody, for listening. And, again, I will be here again next week, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific at www.europac.net. Make sure and order my book, Crash Proof, and watch the video on YouTube. I mailed out the video for my seminar from 2 years ago at the Money Show, and also that bull bear debate we were talking about. Both those videos are on YouTube. You can do a search, Peter Schiff Money Show, and they will come up on YouTube. Anyway, thanks again for listening, and remember to cancel those Forbes subscriptions and let the publishers know why you're doing it. Thanks for listening. I will be here again next week.